You're listening to highlights of the Creative Processes interview with Irvin Weathersby Jr., author of In Open Contempt, Confronting White Supremacy in Art and Public Space. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
One of the biggest symbols of America is Mount Rushmore, this monument, right? But I think most people fail to realize where it's located and why it's located there, and even more importantly, who did it, right? So one, it's on a sacred Native American mountain, right? A place where this was central to their creation stories. But then you think about who did it, and it was a Klansman. The guy who sculpted Mount Rushmore was a Klansman. People are like, wait, really? Like, how is that a thing? And it seeps into our understanding, our embrace of white supremacy. This whole notion of us using Mount Rushmore as a metric of excellence. And so it's really sad that we're honoring slave owners and people who killed natives viciously and people who pillaged other lands in the name of capitalism. And that's what America is, I guess. You know, I'm of two minds with that. I think that you're right, that sometimes the speed at which change is so conspicuous creates this equally and maybe even more powerfully conspicuous backlash. However, I'm selfish in the way that I want to live the best life I can while I have it, right? I think everyone deserves that. I think every human at every age deserves to live the best time that they can or the best life that they can. However, I'm also aware of what my ancestors have said and what they have endured and recognize I have a lot more freedoms, albeit they're still limited, albeit they're still encroached upon. I'm thinking of Kwame Ture, and I'm going to paraphrase something that he said. Ultimately, yes, our ancestors were enslaved, but we have an opportunity to really try to do the best that we can and do it as perfectly as we can to set up the next generation. After talking to people and doing some more reflection, I think it's very clear to me that my upbringing in the church has a really outsized influence on my writing in terms of the Black oral tradition. Every Sunday of my youth, I was in a church, and I'm not necessarily overly religious now, but the music in the church and the actual sermons, the words, the actual Bible, all of these things were cataloging in many ways. Right. As you mentioned, my grandmother was very formative in my writing. She noticed very early on that I had an interest in reading and writing, and she fed me books, information, and really encouraged me in ways that I didn't really know what was happening. It's really bizarre now that I have kids and be able to see that distance and that connection between me and them, and to think about this woman and to see her connection to me and looking at this little boy who had an affinity for words. You know, it still amazes me that she gave me so much. I was very fortunate enough to be born. I think there's such a disinterest in education in America that is sickening. We can't even agree on facts, you know, where it's like, well, it's up to states' rights to decide. It's like, really? States can say that this is true in one state, but it's not true in another, although these are states united. It's very bizarre. I'm hopeful for a revolution. I'm optimistic. I want radical change. I think we are repeating history. We're going through a cycle of fascism and greed. And I think we're going to see a lot of states collapse. As a result of that, I think people are going to be forced back to their primal needs and concerns. But I think they're going to be forced to think about what makes us human. Like, how do we become more human? Because we've lost that. We've given it up to technology. How can we figure out what makes us a really powerful species again? In the 80s, during the explosion of hip hop, which was incredibly formative in my creative process, I think it's hard to really quantify what it felt like to see Black identities, masculinities, feminine identities, all of it and everything in between really articulated every day on screen and on the radio in this poetic form that really spoke to us viscerally. Like this music was produced by us and for us, and obviously it has been consumed by the world over. Now, at that nascent kind of moment when it was bubbling up, it was electric. It just felt so incredible to kind of hear people that you understood articulating your own expressions and your own feelings and where you came from. And then you grow older and you realize, like, oh, you know, you hear your parents' records and you hear music from the 60s and the 70s, and you go further back, and then New Orleans is huge in jazz. And so I actually played the trumpet when I was a little boy in elementary. And so music was always a part of just my understanding, like the logic of music and just being able to kind of understand celebration and culture in that way. I was so fortunate to be born in that milieu. But when it comes to writing as a professional, and as I kind of got older and really started to understand my gifts, I always lean in on the poets. I want everything that I write to read like a prose poem. Poets are the people who always inject flair and imagination and creativity to my writing. While I often go to their poems, especially, I think the sweet spot for me is poets who write prose. When I read their works, that is what I'm trying to recreate on the page, whether it's Claudia Rankine or Elizabeth Alexander or Natasha Trethewey or Hanif Abdul-Rakib. There's so many of these poets, Ocean Vuong, so many people that have influenced me in terms of the language and the lyricism. And even you just think about Baldwin and his syntax and the complex sentences that he would write and the way he was able to maneuver time to be in the present and the past and the future at once. I truly think that in many ways is unique to Black culture, but is also replicated in other cultures. And so when you think about Native American writers or Latin American writers and how they blend time. And so all of those figures really kind of speak to me. And, you know, even one of my favorite living writers right now, I've read all of his work, is Mohsin Mohammed, Pakistani author. Really, really love how he kind of manipulates time and language and how he infuses his own culture, but also brings everyone else in. These are just a few of, I think, the things that kind of influence the way I write and want to write and the way I want to read, ultimately. I think meditation, whether it's prayer, walking meditation, just looking at nature and engaging with those things, it allows you to transcend. I mean, if I can go back, some of my favorite transcendentalists is Emerson and Thoreau, and how they were able to go in nature and experience a shift in their perspectives. Well, you know, I will bring up another musician, Christian Scott Atunde Ajuda. He's a horn player from New Orleans, and he plays jazz, but he has changed what that really means. He has really kind of expanded that definition. He calls it like creative improvised music, right? He calls it stretch music that includes all forms of music together, whether it's African music, whether it's hip hop, whether it's traditional jazz, and other sounds to kind of fuse and create something that's unique, something that is whole. And I think that is a part of my process. It always has been. Before I even knew I was writing a book, I was always a student inspired by art. If you are going to be an artist, you have to consume art. I tell my students all the time, you can't be a musician who doesn't listen to music. You always need to be reading more than you're writing. Even when you're thinking about art and even visual art, whether it's film, portraiture, murals, landscapes, or whatever, I was fortunate enough to be very attuned to how these things were working in my subconscious and conscious mind. One of the more formative experiences for me that really solidified my relationship with visual art was the first publication I wrote. It was a biography of John Biggers, arguably the most important African-American muralist ever. In the process of writing this biography, I was able to tap into his inspiration, the people who came before him, whether it was Charles White or some of his other contemporaries, Elizabeth Catlett, and all these other people. And I was able to get a greater sense of what art was doing for my community, for my culture, and why it was significant, and get a greater sense of value of it. That was very early on in my writing career. And fortunately, it was actually my first byline, which was paid. I didn't necessarily seek this opportunity out. This was actually given to me by a professor. I truly believe in the universe conspiring to push you forward, serendipity, whatever you want to call it. I truly believe in those forces aligning, astrology or the stars, and all of this working for our benefit if you are pursuing your passions purely, right? Yeah, I think that's the rub. I think that's another thing that artists, museums, curators have to figure that out. The artist Titus Kaphar often talks about this. He had a really awesome documentary. It's called Shut Up and Paint. And in this documentary, he describes that feeling of feeling valued, feeling like, yeah, my art is worth something. People are paying handsomely for it. However, the people that I'm actually featuring the subjects of my art cannot purchase it based on the value that it has risen to. And as a result of them not purchasing it, oftentimes they can't even engage with it. So art that I am creating for these folks is largely invisible to them. It becomes this incredible kind of existential thing. Like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? I think many artists are kind of facing that, where the work is now, as you said, seen as these assets to build wealth. But where does the artistic practice lie? Where is the value in that? And how is that transferred to others? Yeah, you know, I am an engaged parent. I'm an engaged educator. And I'm concerned due to AI. You know, we saw just recently that a journalist or the Chicago Sun-Times was outed for writing an article about books that didn't exist, or a summer reading list full of books that didn't exist. And people are reading it and like, well, wait a minute, these things don't exist. It's really kind of like funny, but not, because it's really sad to be a person who produces art, a person who cares about words and labors over them, for someone to really just haphazardly click a button and almost devalue what that process is. And so I'm really disheartened by the valuation of critical thought, critical engagement, critical writing. As a professor who teaches freshman English, I'm terrified. I really am, in terms of what am I going to do to encourage people to actually use their own brains to produce something. You know, I think many of us are at a loss. Thinking about my own son, because we have so many books in our home, he's a voracious reader. And I think, you know, empirical data has across cultures suggested that the more books you have in your home, the better you will be as a human. And so I think that is my goal in life. How can we learn to engage with art again?
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.